Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our American Cousin Show. This salutes the play attended by President Lincoln, April 14, 1865, when he was shot and mortally wounded. Our American Cousin was first written in 1858 by English playwright Tom Taylor, a farce whose plot is based on the introduction of an awkward, boorish, but honest American to his aristocratic English relatives when he goes to England to claim the family estate. Did you know that, Rick?
No.
Yeah.
No idea.
He meets there Lord Dundreary, and he does something called Dundrearyisms, and I did not know this, but I did this in college.
Why does that not surprise me?
Well,
I bet you there's things you could tell us about your college days.
And in fact, I will. But they're not very exciting. But what happened? Dundrearyism was something in the late 1800s that was pretty popular. You would mash together two wise sayings to create nonsense. And the most famous one from Lord Dundreary in Our American Cousin, he said, "Birds of a feather gather no moss." So, now, here's what happened. I was really fretting over a test. This was going to be...
Isn't that like a rolling stone?
Right. It's pushing two things together. So, I had a test coming up, and I was really worried about it. My roommate was trying to reassure me. He said, remember, Tony, it's always darkest before the storm, which is...
which is another one of those.
Which is terrible advice. It was the calm before the storm and the darkness before the dawn, but you put them together, and you've got just a horrendous situation.
But tell me, have you or have you not in your life done that? Two together?
Yeah.
Well, Why do we as humans want to do that? Well, I've done it.
I started my best one I put together was a bird in the hand's worth beating around the bush. So it sounds at first you think, hey, that's something smart. I know that's a familiar smart thing. And then you think, no, that's really stupid. It's always darkest before the storm is horrible advice.
Right. Well, but it sounds, you know.
Yeah, but it sounds familiar. At any rate, that actually came out of Our American Cousin. And I thought in honor of, again, April 14th, we're recording this mid-April. It would be nice to just take a moment just to remember President Lincoln and his unfortunate end. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio with us from the University of Kentucky, the manager of communications infrastructure, to explain to you how Health Matters can be accessed via the World Wide Web. Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know, you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org. That's Moorhead State Public Radio's website. Jump on over there, do a little search through the menus, find Health Matters. There you'll find a list of all the more recent shows. There's a little summary, so in case you're really worried about which one you want to listen to, you can kind of read the summary and tell, was that the funny one or the other funny one? You know, right, or the good one or the other good
one. Yeah, well, you're being optimistic.
No. That's what we do. That's how we've stayed on the air after 12 years. Those are just wonderful, right? So you're listening to them there on WMKY.org. If you by chance know what a podcast is and you are a podcaster, there's a link there for you. You can also find that podcast link on iTunes. And if you don't know about podcasting, I would say just Google it up and see what you can figure out. What it does is it allows you to get Moorhead State Public Radio to send you the audio of the show about 4 days after it airs, and it'll come right to you automagically. And then you can just listen to it on whatever device you are podcasting on. After that, jump over to Facebook, do a search for HM Radio Show, or just go to facebook.com/HM Radio Show, and there you'll find the fan page, or for Health Matters,
the old pan page, as we call it.
Pan page. Well, at least I didn't put two things together, right? I mean, you know, I didn't Facebook, and anyway, no, nonetheless.
Let those on the fan page cast the first stone.
Well, no, please don't. Jump over there, interact with the show. That's your opportunity to interact with the show, whatever you call us, the co-hosts, hosts, everything. We post things in there from time to time. We do things that are all relevant in the news, parts of the show, answering questions from listeners. Sometimes we look in there and we find stuff to get show topics for. So, I mean, if you want us to talk about something or you have a question, facebook.com/HM Radio Show is where you go.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Visiting Scholar Studying the Science of Hospital Visitation, GWISIT Takes Preparation to Visit. Now, we've done this sponsor before. I want to remind our Health Matters Radio fans about visiting the hospital. And there's a new guidance statement out from the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America, that is SHE. And SHE says that they have some comments about visiting the hospital and how hospitals should manage visitors when the person who's in the hospital has a an infection, something that might be contagious. So I just want to remind you of the general rules for visiting a hospital. I've got my top 10 rules here, and we'll go five this time. First of all, don't visit if you are sick. It is not a good idea if you yourself are sick to visit a person in the hospital. You can easily make things worse. If you must, consider wearing a mask. Wash your hands frequently. Please protect your friend, the healthcare workers, and the other patients in the hospital. Don't spread illness in the hospital. Number two, don't assume you'll be allowed to visit. There are certain respiratory infections that where visitors are not allowed. The patient themselves may be tired and request no visitors. They may be undergoing a procedure. They may have other conditions that will limit their visitation. So it may be possible that you would go there and not be able to see your loved one, at least temporarily. Please respect the restrictions of the hospital. They are there for a reason. They really don't just project authority very often. The third one, isolation precautions. And this, again, is where the Hospital Society of America steps in. If you have, if your loved one has a note on the door that they are in isolation, many times the healthcare workers will have to put on gloves and a gown to go in. The most common isolation in American hospitals is generally the methicillin-resistant staff. We call that MRSA. And if your loved one has MRSA, they may be wearing those gowns to keep from transferring it to other patients. Now, according to the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology people, probably if your loved one has this methicillin-resistant staph, then probably you've got it on your skin, too, if you're living with that person. It's common enough in the community that healthy people can visit in the hospital without catching it. So it may be the hospital people have gowns, gloves. It may be that you don't. That's not because they are sacrificing you. It's because they have to go to a sick patient next door, whereas you don't. If you are a chaplain, if you are a person who's visiting several people in the hospital, it may make a difference. So be sure and let your nurse know that you may be visiting more than one person. That may change the way they enforce precautions. Number four, and I'll stop there, wash your hands. Wash your hands before you see the patient to protect them. Wash your hands after you leave to protect your family and the other people that you will be seeing the rest of the day. It's also okay to ask staff if they wash their hands. Everyone who sees your loved one should wash your hand. So that's our first four tips for visiting the hospital from the visiting scholar studying the science of visitation. Gee whiz, it takes preparation to visit. Now, a brief anatomy lesson, Rick.
Okay.
If you make a fist with your hand and you move your thumb in and out of the fist, if you put your hand over the inside of your forearm, you can feel motion underneath your fingers. That motion is your extensor pollicis longus tendon. It starts up on the forearm, goes across your wrist, and allows you to give the thumbs up signal to approve of someone with one hand, to hitch a ride, or to push the elevator button with your thumb extended. Now, this case report was in the American Medical Association Journal of a 29-year-old man. He was right-handed. He had chronic left thumb pain, and he was no longer able to lift his thumb up. He could no longer express approval with a thumbs-up sign. He could no longer hitchhike because he could not lift his thumb away from his hand. He had been playing a video game on his smartphone all day for 6 to 8 weeks. This is a guy who apparently played constantly with his left hand, even while he was using his right hand for other tasks. He would sit there with his thumb, punching buttons on his smartphone all day long for over a month.
What are you supposed to say to that? I mean, I don't even know what to say.
Well, playing was a secondary thing, he says, but it was constantly on. While playing it, he felt no pain. He had no injury, no prior operations to either hand, no risk factors. But when they evaluated him, he had ruptured the tendon to his thumb.
Ouch.
Now, this is...
Why does that sound painful?
Well, it should be painful. You know, you think if you pop your Achilles tendon, which is, that's a bigger tendon than this, but basically rupturing a tendon is a painful thing. The other thing is you think, well, okay, maybe he had a thin tendon. This tendon was ruptured right in the middle part of it, which is actually the thicker part when they went in. They had to do a tendon transplant. They transferred, what they did was transferred one of the tendons that moves his index finger. They moved it over so it would move his thumb, so he had some use of his thumb. But apparently, their thinking is that repeatedly moving his thumb up and down, he managed to rupture the tendon. And the amazing thing about it was either that rupture occurred in segments, that is, he tore it a little at a time, and or he did not feel the pain of it. Now, you know, we've had on this show, we've said that video gaming and gaming is a good post-operative pain control measure. People who play video games after their surgeries have less pain and need less pain medications because their mind is so intent on the video game.
Right.
And I know you've had people, both the, I don't know if you've done it yourself. I've certainly done it. If you are on a video game, it's hard to even carry on a conversation with somebody.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he apparently, the thinking was he was so busy with this thing with his left hand that he did not notice he was tearing the tendon of his thumb off.
Where do you go? I mean, how does that be? I mean, are you that detached or do you have such a high pain threshold that you don't tell? I don't know. That's odd.
Isn't it odd? Now, you know, obviously there's not been an epidemic of thumb tendon ruptures since we started playing video games on the phone. But
oh, but it's going to be the new latest greatest thing.
The
right?
The thumb tendons or phones. I don't know. I will say, you know, I watch my medical students, and the way they use their thumbs is completely different than anything I ever did with my thumb. I mean, you know, again, they, and we've looked. I think we even presented on the show.
Well, you were a hitchhiker. They weren't.
Yeah, I basically put the thumb out. I would I might lick it sometimes.
What was the farthest you ever hitchhiked?
I think one time. Oh, I remember. I absolutely remember. It was only about 5 miles. We were out in the middle of the woods. Friends and I were rafting down this creek, and we
you
basically
forgot that your car was going to be 5 miles back behind you.
No, no, we got into some dead water, and we could not go any further, and it got dark. So we climbed out, hitched a ride back to where we put in.
Why does this sound like there was some improper planning on your part?
Oh, listen. Why
does that sound like...
All right, let's just say I am lucky to be alive as far as that goes, because we would wait for a big rain, and then we would hop on this raft, and we would go down the creek beds. It was no life jackets, no helmets.
How old were you?
We were in high school. We were old enough to drive.
Well,
but this was my one of my big stupids in high school that I'm very glad I survived.
This is coming from the guy who had BB gun wars.
Yeah, okay. But... Sure. If you want to list stupid, I mean, I have a fairly long stupid list from high school. This was one of them. I did hitchhike.
Did it ever get you any girls?
Stupid? No. No, my stupid was not the right kind of stupid. What you're referring to is if I do something incredibly stupid,
you
the guys around
attention.
Me will be impressed, and the girls will notice that I must be important because everyone's so impressed with my
you're
stupid.
You're the alpha.
Yeah, I'm the alpha because I'm stupider than anybody else in my group. I was never that way. I did the quiet stupid that just gets you killed, really, is what it does. But obviously, you're stalling because you don't want to talk about what happens to your thumb when you play a video game on your phone for 6 weeks all day.
No, because I can't even fathom that. I mean, I can't get a job. Cook something. You know, what? How did you change? I mean, get a two-handed remote for your TV. Something. I mean, you know.
Yeah, you would think. I mean,
although that probably is the same kind of motion.
And you know, smartphone games, these are not the most elegant games.
No.
You know, they're not exactly
playing a bad game.
This guy was immersed in some silly game, I'm sure, and ruined his thumb. Now he's got a tendon transposition just so he can move his thumb.
Good thing we don't like hitchhiking anymore.
Move your thumbs off the radio set. We're going to take a break and come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our American Cousin show.
Cousin.
Yeah. Which is the show that was attended by Abraham Lincoln on April 14th, 1865, and unfortunately also attended by John Wilkes Booth.
So let me ask you this. Why don't we talk about the Titanic? Because, you know, the Titanic just as well was a one. You know, April, and this is bad because, you know, I have a wonderful woman in my life who shares a birthday with the sinking of the Titanic and the death of Abraham Lincoln.
And Tax Day.
That's the perpetual evil.
Disaster cluster. In fact, stay tuned next week. We'll talk about the Titanic because Rick and I are recording these shows on Tax Day, and we thought it would be good to talk about disasters. I mean, that's what we
do. What Tax Day is.
Yeah, it sure is. So Titanic will be next week. Assassination of President Lincoln is this week, and we named this show Our American
Cousin. You ever
been
to the Ford Theater?
I have not, but I'm told it's very small.
It is very small. And it makes you wonder. But yeah, it's extremely small.
So did you stand on the edge of the balcony there and yell Sic Semper Tyrannis or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
But I watched the reenactment.
You did?
Well, something like that. Okay. It was a video of it.
Oh.
They had a video playing.
Just somebody stop him. That was, you would think. But I guess things were kind of, I suppose, you know, I always think he pulled out a gun. I was thinking, well, gee, it had more bullets in the chamber. But, of course, it was 1860.
Right.
I don't know what type of weapon he had, but I suspect he had pretty well, that was it.
He probably had two shots.
You think he had two?
Yeah, they probably had, you know, double barrels back then. You could have two barrels, one with each, you know. They didn't have anything really, I don't think. They might have had revolvers at that point, but I
bet they had revolvers, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, they probably had revolvers, but
I don't know what type of weapon he used. That is the thing I don't
know.
But
I tell you what, I can't help thinking about that incident without thinking about good old Samuel Mudd, and your name is Mudd. I just, you know, it's pretty amazing how
you opportunities are offered. You're a hero, you're a martyr.
So the question is, was he helping as his doing his doctorly oath, or was he an accomplice?
You know, I think so many times we've argued about this before that I think if I'm in the middle of something, I don't necessarily recognize the implications of everything I do.
But your medical oath says that you're going to help somebody. If somebody shows up with a broken leg and you don't know who it is,
yeah,
you're going to help them.
Yeah.
If you know who they are, you're going to help them.
Yeah, not necessarily escape, but I'll try to help ease their suffering, and that's true.
So anyway, I just think it's interesting. Samuel Mudd.
All right. Our sponsor for the second time, the Visiting Scholars, Gee Whiz, it takes preparation to visit. We are talking about hospital visitation. Remind you from last time, don't visit your friends in the hospital, your relatives in the hospital if you are sick. Don't assume you'll be allowed to visit. There may be either procedures being done or other reasons why you might not be allowed to visit. Make sure you have permission before you start. Respect the isolation precautions. And as we said, for most skin conditions, such as methicillin-resistant staph or MRSA, the healthcare workers may be wearing gloves and gowns. You may not. The reason they're wearing them is they're going to go next door and take care of somebody else, and you are not. If you are visiting several people in the hospital, it may be that you need to take additional precautions beyond what the usual family members would take. Number four, wash your hands. And again, I'll go back to the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology. What they said about washing hands: all visitors should perform hand hygiene prior to entering a patient room and immediately after leaving the room. Both hand washing with soap and water and proper use of an alcohol-based rub are acceptable. The institution should ensure that you have a place to wash your hands. The alcohol-based rubs in the sinks are available. But you wash going in for your loved one in the hospital. You wash coming out for the family back home. Don't take those hospital germs home with you. Rule number five, never wake a sleeping patient. Sleep is a very difficult thing to get in the hospital if they're asleep. That is an important thing. Number six, don't bring food without checking with the staff. There are special diets and diet limitations, and we may be mistaken. It may be that once they eat a regular meal, they can go home, and if you bring in a late-night snack and kill their appetite, you may actually cause them to spend extra time in the hospital. Number seven, for the same reason, don't eat the patient's food. We may be monitoring how much they eat. We may be mistaken, thinking that they're eating healthily while you are wolfing down their portions. Also, sometimes the food has medications mixed in with it. You do not want to be taking your loved one's hospital medications. Bad idea there. Number eight, don't smoke before visiting or during a visit. Even if you excuse yourself, the odor comes in, and especially for people who have difficulty with their breathing, that can be a problem. Number nine, turn the ringer off on the cell phone. In most cases now, we are allowing cell phone use in the hospital, but please respect those signs. Don't start a fight. It's not worth it. 10, do not bring small children to the hospital. Dangerous for them. Dangerous for the staff. Can spread germs places we didn't think and bring in their own germs. They roll. They play in the germs. This is just a bad idea all the way around. That's our sponsor, the Visiting Scholars, studying the science of hospital visitation. G-Wizit takes preparation to visit. Rick, do you like cheese?
Absolutely.
Isn't cheese wonderful? This was an article published.
You have a favorite kind?
You know, I'm so bland. First of all, I eat a lot of American cheese, but after I read this, I think I will be going to other types.
Like what?
Well, I will do cheddar and Colby, and those are not very exciting. But as far as, you know,
No pepper jack for you? I mean, that's getting on the edge right there
No, I'll eat pepper jack, but it's not one of my favorites. It's not the one I buy. We buy very bland cheese at home.
Really? Like, you see, now if I'm gonna have cheese on something or I want to shred it like an omelet or something, then I can go with the medium or the sharp cheddar. But if I'm gonna eat it in slices or blocks, boy, I really like the mild cheddar.
Well, we have, when I go to events that have cheese, I'll try most anything they've got there. I figure cheese, you know, I mean, you can get into some really bad cheese, but
some good brie.
Yeah. That was pretty rare. This was from the Journal of Agricultural
Macaroni
and Food
cheese.
Chemistry. Oh, please. That's you know, it you was love it, you know. It was published March 2nd, and it was about cheese, and they're using something called metabolomics, I believe is the way you pronounce it. Basically, they look at the metabolism of the germs in the gut. What are the byproducts being produced for cheese? Now, here's the thing, Rick. We're going to talk about yogurt in a minute, but yogurt has a good reputation right now. Yogurt introduces good germs into your gut. Yogurt may affect your own biome, your gut biome, change the bacteria in your gut. This is a great thing. Well, cheese actually does the same thing. Now, American cheese, as it turns out, has no germs at all in it because we pasteurize everything and we sterilize everything. And so American cheese is the most bland of cheese. But if you go to these other cheeses you've been talking about, some of them have bacteria in them. And the question from these researchers was, what do these bacterial, you won't call them infested or bacterial laden cheeses do to your biome? And they do change the metabolism in your gut. Now, we initially thought, there's something called the French paradox. We initially thought that French people had a low risk of heart disease because they drank a lot of wine. Yeah, it turns out drinking wine hasn't been quite as healthy as we thought. It's not a bad idea, but it certainly has not rated a recommendation to drink wine for your health. Maybe these researchers in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry, maybe the French paradox in part may be related to cheese. Like I said,
you're saying the people in Wisconsin are healthier than everybody else?
Well, but the problem is, if you go with American cheese, it's got all the chemicals, it's got all the fats that cheese has. It does not have the bacteria. So it may be the difference between France and Madison is the fact that the French have bacteria on the cheese.
Dirty French cheese.
Maybe. They took 15 healthy men. The diets were either high in cheese or high in milk, or there was a control diet with no dairy products.
These are people who maybe thought of quiche, right?
Yeah. I guess. I don't know.
French. I mean,
French. I went to France, but I will tell you, when I was in France, I ate the
American
stuff I knew.
Food.
Well, I did not eat at American restaurants. No, did not take peanut butter.
Did you take any crackers?
I figured I could eat French stuff, but as far as knowing what to order on a French menu, I had no idea.
We could make a movie out of you going to France.
Because
I bet it would be hilarious.
I loved Paris. I did not expect I would love Paris. I absolutely adored Paris. It was a wonderful place.
Okay. What did you love about it?
The museums are remarkable. You can get a pass. You can go to all these museums. You can see
artwork.
Well,
they're older than anything we have in America.
Yeah, and Notre Dame. I just thought about what had happened in Notre Dame over the past 900 years.
Did you go up the Eiffel Tower?
Yeah.
I bet you did.
And it was amazing. It was amazing. It was. Back to the article.
No, let's stay talking about France.
I am. These are 15 healthy Frenchmen. I believe they're Frenchmen. I'm not sure. At any
they're
rate,
cheese-eating Frenchmen.
They eat European cheese, and perhaps then our problem has been we always look at cheese in terms of the chemicals in it, the saturated fats and so forth. We never looked at it in terms of what it does to the living organisms in your colon. And their theory, which is supported somewhat from their work, I mean, there's a lot to be worked out here, is that it does, like yogurt, it does have some change in the way your gut metabolizes food, and that means that cheese could, even though it's on the surface is bad in terms of its chemical components. I mean, it's just full of fats. It still could actually lower your risk of heart disease by changing the gut flora. Now, this is, again, we're making a changeover from the chemical aspects of food into the biologic aspects of food, and I'm very excited about this. I think that another look at cheese would be good.
I like cheese. I'm all for it. Let's do some research here at Health Hunters.
Like I said, the American cheese is that's
I'll have Gouda. Brie. We'll do something that's not American.
I have never eaten Limburger.
I can't get past that smell.
Okay,
it's pretty stuff.
Yeah,
I heard somebody. Oh, I was watching. Matter of fact, I'm a kind of a closet Hell's Kitchen guy. I like watching that show.
Yeah,
and they brought out an episode a few weeks ago was kind of based on cheese, and I didn't realize there's like 700 kinds of cheese. 700. Think about that.
Oh, that's a lot of cheese.
That's a lot of cheese.
And apparently they have to paint on salt to grow some of these smear bacteria that are on the
cheddar,
surface
American,
that make it smell
Parmesan.
Bad. You got to work hard to get them to smell that bad.
You really do.
Because those
it
those,
takes time.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of effort. I don't know. I'll never get to there, but I think I'm going to have to rethink American cheese.
Okay.
Kraft singles may not be
as bad
the epitome
as
of cheese. No, they have no bacteria in them. If I am dealing with gut bacteria, I might be better off to be more adventurous.
Does it sound good saying that you're going to put gut bacteria in your food? Does that make it sound more appealing or less appealing?
I think we have to reach some kind
depends
of a compromise
gut,
with the world around us. Yeah.
It depends on the gut.
Yeah. It's not like we can live in a sterile bubble and everything be sterilized that goes into us. I don't think that's an ideal way to live.
Okay. If you say so.
Theoretically saying that.
It's a cheesy answer.
Here's the thing. Rick has been taking notes. He's been scribbling furiously. He's been waiting. He says, ooh, 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 there might be a joke here.
No, there's lots of jokes here. Some are good. Some we let just go.
Next up, yogurt and weight management. Because
what?
I wanted to put this in. This was last year.
You're a
year.
Yogurt eater, I bet.
I do eat quite a bit of yogurt.
Yeah, you're probably a Greek yogurt eater.
Well,
because that word Greek on there means so much more.
It's got bacteria.
Great.
It is it not is. Sterile. That's the truth. And supposedly it's got good
You're
bacteria.
You're a dirty eater.
I don't know how to respond to that. In a recent cross-sectional analysis, 6,500 American adults, yogurt consumers were more likely than those who did not consume yogurt to have a better overall diet quality and higher potassium intake, less likely to have inadequate intakes of vitamins. And, of course, in addition to the proteins that are in yogurt, it's more concentrated. The ingredients of yogurt are more concentrated than those in milk. And, of course, there are the probiotics. There are the bacteria that are in yogurt that may, in fact, have some relationship to your gut. Now, we've not made this argument for cheese, but we've made it for yogurt. So this was a review. This is not a new research paper, but a review. And they said, what does yogurt do as far as weight management? And the answer is, well, apparently not very much, or we don't know very much. You think, well, I'll eat yogurt to lose weight because yogurt is a good
food.
Not
if you eat 6 cups.
Well, that's true. But the other thing is, apparently, even if you...
That's why they sell them in 6-pack.
Anybody... Well, for people like you, but I just read that most people who eat yogurt are actually very healthy eaters otherwise. They eat yogurt as a part of a healthy diet.
So if you're the yogurt company, who would you rather sell to?
Yeah.
The guy that eats 6 at a time? Or those little thin people that eat it once a week?
But you've got to convince the 6 guy that it's actually healthy by using the thin people.
No, you don't. You just got to convince him it tastes good.
Yogurt tastes good. Now we got bacon-wrapped yogurt.
Exactly.
We got deep-crushed yogurt.
Put yogurt in a bacon bowl. I saw on Facebook the other day, somebody, you know what the Stanley Cup is?
Yeah.
In hockey? They created a Stanley Cup made of bacon. Well, that would be cool.
This is like carving Elvis out of butter.
Think about it.
Yes, you can do it, but the fact that you can, why should you?
I don't know, but it was cool. I mean, that's the beauty of Facebook. You just never know what you're going
to
see.
Back to the study. Yogurt, for many people, is considered to be healthy. But when you look at yogurt and weight management, there's only been 2 small studies published that looked at yogurt alone, not yogurt and other dairy products.
What do you mean by small study?
Short term, they were we're looking at that 15 to 30 people type of study for short term. And there was greater weight loss in people who ate yogurt, but it was pretty small and only significant in 1 of the 2 trials. There are 5 observational studies that have looked at yogurt and weight gain, but again, about half of them show that people who eat yogurt gain more weight, and half show they gain less weight. So it's not clear that yogurt really does anything very good. I didn't really put this review on because it had astonishing results, but I'm turning here to the back page of this, and they say underlying mechanisms. And they mention yogurt is a concentrated dairy product, more nutrients, more calcium than milk, and these calcium, which is abundant, has been shown to facilitate loss of weight and fat mass in other settings. And of course, there is much recent evidence supporting a role of gut microbiota in weight control, and as a fermented dairy product, yogurt is a good source of probiotic bacteria. Now, the thing about it is, they'll make that argument for yogurt, but you don't hear anybody making that argument for cheese, and we at Health Matters feel that cheese is being unfairly singled out as having, as you said, Rick, bad bacteria, whereas yogurt has good bacteria, and there's no proof for that.
Yeah, it's all dirty.
You know, I'm making a declarative statement. We are making history here. And
we're making something.
Yeah. And Rick is you're not going along with the
No,
the
I'm going along. I think we're making something.
Okay. So, while we're talking about yogurt, which has a great reputation, and yet yogurt the reputation doesn't hold up as much. That is, it's not like you can see marked health benefits from yogurt, but we are making the case that if yogurt does this, it's possible that cheese does it. Rick is reminding me, I even have on there, that April 12th was National Grilled Cheese Sandwich Day.
Was it day or month?
Your
note to me says month.
I know it did, and I went back and checked that. One of my sources said month, but when I went to all the official things, and by the way, there apparently is a food celebration. Everything from almonds to caramel cake, everything has its day. There's a licorice day. I think we're fasting approaching licorice,
Ew.
National Licorice Day.
You probably like licorice.
It was a grilled cheese day. I do not like licorice. As a matter of fact, as a doctor, I worry about it.
Licorice,
if you get real licorice rather than that plasticky stuff, it can change your potassium levels, and so it can be a little dangerous.
Okay.
Got one more thing, something that has been panned in the past. I think most people are willing to accept that coffee probably is neutral or maybe beneficial to your health. And again, coffee's been linked to a reduced risk of coronary heart disease, type 2 diabetes, Parkinson's disease, stroke, liver cancer, and dementia, and it appears to have some memory-boosting properties. Again, these linkages mean that it's been associated, but we can't prove anything. This was a look at coffee and skin cancer. Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah, very much so.
Coffee intake, they did a food frequency questionnaire at baseline for 500,000 white people who were cancer-free at baseline. They developed 2,900 cases of melanoma over the next 10 years, and they went back to their initial food intake questionnaire, and they said, well, how many cups of coffee you take? If you take more than 4 cups of coffee a day, your risk of developing melanoma drops by 20%. That's not a lot, because melanoma is a pretty rare thing, but if you drink 4 or more cups of coffee, 20% less likely to develop melanoma. And by the way,
You a coffee drinker?
You know, I struggle with it. I want to be a coffee drinker, and yet not that coffee flavored milkshake stuff you get. Actual black coffee, maybe a little bit of sweetener in it. I really struggle with that.
See, so me, I would be one of those guys that would be. They would throw me out of the study because I've got a K-cup, you know, the Keurig.
Yeah.
And so I take one K-cup and I put it in, and I have a really big cup it brews into. I like the big mugs, right? So I brew one, and I don't take the K-cup out. I just open it and re-brew another cup that's of the smaller one. So it ends up being about 16, 18 ounces, something like that.
And
I've run it through twice.
I see.
And so is it 2 cups of coffee? Is it one really big watered-down cup of coffee? And they'd have to throw me out because they wouldn't know how to do it.
I wouldn't trust you. Of course, I don't trust you about anything
so
much.
Ponder that for a little bit.
Yeah. Caffeinated worked, decaffeinated didn't work. That's what we know about coffee and melanoma. We also know it's time for you to take a break. Why not get
a cup of coffee,
have some cheese, skip the yogurt, you can get that later, and return for our final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I've got a cup of coffee and I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, the cheese man.
The cheese head.
I wish I could say that, but honestly, my cheese choices, as a practical matter, are so bland, it's not even worth
discussing. Your cheese is individually sliced or individually wrapped.
And that right there, that just tells you that you're not even a cheese player. You need a big wheel, a hunk.
But think about it
like that.
If your cheese is wrapped at all, you're probably not a real cheese eater.
Fair
right?
Enough.
I mean, because don't those it's not a ball.
It's a wheel.
A wheel.
Yeah.
A cheese wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got the cheese wheel sitting out, you're probably a cheese eater.
Fair enough. I am going to, this is one of my goals. I'm going to try to become more adventurous in my cheese choices.
Really?
I think I owe it to my gut
mozzarella?
Bacteria. No, I mean, I already do that. I do, I you know, I'll do
you're
Swiss.
You're going to get it stuffed in the
cheddar.
Crust of your pizza?
I'll do pepper jack. No, because that stuff is not cheese, as you well know. That is cheesy
don't
material.
Bust my bubble. Goodness gracious, Tony. Just ruin it for everybody, why don't you?
This is the our American Cousin Show, and our sponsor for the final time is the visiting scholar studying the science of hospital visitation. 10 rules if you are visiting a friend or a loved one in the hospital. 1, don't visit if you're sick. 2, don't assume you'll be allowed to visit. With procedures with certain types of illnesses, you may not be allowed to. 3, respect the isolation precautions. Again, talk to the nurses about this. It may be that they have precautions because they are caring for other patients that you may not have to have. Let them know if you're visiting several people in the hospital. We don't want to be transferring bacteria from one room to another. 4, wash your hands. Wash your hands when you go in. For the patient, wash your hands immediately when you leave for your family and the people at home. 5, never wake a sleeping patient. 6, don't bring food in without checking with the staff. There may be dietary restrictions. 7, do not eat the patient's food. It may have medications in it. It may be that they're on some restrictive diet and they're watching to see how much food is left over. That is just always a bad idea. 8, don't smoke before visiting or during a visit. That can affect people with respiratory problems, even if you're not actually smoking in the room. 9, please respect the cell phone rules. Some of them make sense, some don't, but you don't want to go to the hospital and pick a fight. And 10, do not bring small children into the hospital. There are so many ways that can go wrong, we can't even detail them all on a one-hour radio show. But unless there is absolutely no choice, don't bring them. If you do bring them, let them visit. Get them in. Get them out quickly. Do not allow your child to be crawling over the furniture, playing in the floor of a hospital, and picking up resistant germs while they're there visiting. That's our sponsor, the Visiting Scholar, studying the science of hospital visitation. GWISIT takes preparation to visit. Got some things on the cost of medications. I think we got to talk about this, Rick. It's a pretty big deal. A couple of facts.
You're a pretty big deal.
Well, thank you, I think.
Yeah, exactly. How do you mean that?
You're just saying things at random right now. You're not to.
It's not random.
Yeah.
There's a method, but okay. you just don't understand me. You don't know me anymore.
Here's what you do. You listen to this show and turn the balance on your radio so that you're getting all Rick and none of me and figure out.
Well, there'd be long pauses where nothing
there
would get said.
You'd say, you're a big deal. You don't like cheese. You eat bacon.
I love cheese. Yeah, I love bacon.
I know, but these are the comments that will be coming out of your speaker, and I'm not sure that that's worth it. As a matter of fact, if you want, you can just turn the balance the other way and just tune Rick out.
Well, then you're going to sound kind of silly.
I'll be defending myself.
The day that you understand that we're a balance.
No, most of the time you'll be hearing
me. I make the listeners
trying to correct
you.
The errors, and
you
so
understand
that would be confusing.
I make them appreciate you.
That's right. Maybe your purpose in life is to serve as a horrible example. This was from the Dallas Morning News back on April 3rd. Medicare is barred by law from negotiating with the pharmaceutical industry over its prices. It is illegal to import medications, and this is what you want to know. In other words, the pharmaceutical companies, they have you. There is not competition. In fact, I'm making this purposely edgy, but it is the absolute truth. They use the FDA as an enforcer to make sure that you cannot get a deal on your medications. And Americans, as we know, by a wide margin, we have the highest medication costs anywhere in the world. In 2014, the reason this is important, in 2014, the total cost that we spend on prescription drugs in this country jumped by 13%. That is a huge rise in the cost of prescription drugs. Now, to be fair, part of that jump was the fact that we had a massive expansion of Medicaid across the nation, and Medicaid pays for prescription drugs. So just the Medicaid expansion caused a substantial jump in price. But this has allowed pharmaceutical companies to make out like bandits. Cancer drugs, hepatitis C treatments increased 31% in 2014. Their prices are expected to go up another 44% this year. They are breaking the bank, and unfortunately, by the way that Medicare pays and by the Medicaid expansion that we put through the Affordable Care Act, there's no way to bargain with them. There's no way to control costs. The cost of these specialty drugs, these are new. We call them biologic agents. We use them for cancer, for rheumatoid arthritis and hepatitis. It was $87 billion in 2012, and by 2020, it's probably going to go to $400 billion. Total prescription
drugs. How much you say?
$400 billion.
That's $400 billion.
Yeah, billion with a B. Drugs by 2020, just for these specialty drugs. Now, our total prescription drug spending across all the drugs in 2014 was about $300 billion already. $87 billion of that is on these new biologic agents, and that is the one that's going to jump by around 50%.
Can we even get the concept of what $400 billion is?
Well, Well, let me go on. I'll just tell you, this is from the Wall Street Journal, April 8th. State Medicaid programs across the country spent $1.3 billion on the hepatitis C drugs, and that's mainly on Sovaldi, the one that we've been hitting pretty much every show. That's the $1,000 a pill drug that treats hepatitis C, and our state Medicaid programs spent $1.3 billion on this drug that did not exist before a couple of years ago.
Right.
So, again, the costs there are going up. That was they've spent $1.08 billion on it the first 9 months of 2014. That's 82% of all hepatitis C drug spending. And this was this is kind of interesting. Sovaldi, the hepatitis C drug that did not exist 2 years ago, was the third largest drug expenditure for Medicaid across the country. Number one is Abilify. It's an antipsychotic medication also used for depression. You see that advertised all the time on TV. Number two is Lipitor. See that advertised all the time, and it's been around right. for a while, but it's a mainstay of cholesterol treatment. Abilify, we spent $1.7 billion.
Seen it on TV a few times.
Yeah, Lipitor, we were $1.1 billion. And then Sovaldi, the hepatitis C drug, which you don't see too much of on TV, that's the third largest Medicaid drug expenditure. And here's some ways that people, first of all, we can't afford this. This will not work. This is not sustainable. It is this is not going to continue. Texas spent $0, nothing on Sovaldi.
Wow.
They just decided they are not going to pay for it. It's too expensive.
They don't have any of that problem in their state.
You know, this is the third largest Medicaid population in the country.
But they don't have any problem with it.
And their Medicaid is simply not paying for Sovaldi.
Nice.
Yeah. They decided not to.
I mean, you know, I say nice, but, you know, That's kind of one of those medical ethics questions.
Yes, absolutely.
It's tough to make that decision, and you got to wonder, what is that – there's probably some kind of governance system in place to determine what gets paid and what doesn't, and how did they come to that conclusion?
Well, Rick,
what was the cost?
I wish – when you say a governance structure, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, gee, I bet you there were scientists and clinicians down and hash out what are the benefits and the risk. But, you push back from that right away. The answer is no. This is not a medical decision based on the years of expected life or the potential savings or anything like that. It is just this drug is too darned expensive. We're not paying.
This is a benefit
we will not offer our Medicaid population because we know we can't afford to do it.
Well, I mean, I think the argument there would be, the defense that they would present to the population is we're going to spend, you know, X percent of the budget to cure or to deal with a very, very, very small portion of the population. And so I think it's really how do you prioritize the limited healthcare dollars you have? And I think that's what it comes down to. And boy, is that a tough thing to try to be a part of.
Right. The thing that I want to make our radio fans aware of, this is not just simply dollars and cents. This is not balancing budgets. This is life and death. If you divert your Medicaid spending to paying for this hepatitis drug, And remember, this drug clears the virus from your system. Does it prevent you from having a liver transplant? We don't know. Does the virus come back after it's cleared? We don't know. Do you have to continue taking this round after round after round the rest of your life?
We don't know.
All we know is that a few months after you take this drug, we can't measure the virus in your system, which may or may not make you a healthier person. We're not sure. For that, we're paying $1,000 a pill, and we are shorting other diseases and other conditions.
Oh, and by the way, you're going to have to take like 80 pills, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you got to, 84,000. You got to take 80 pills. You're going to be you'll be on this for 6 weeks and maybe longer. You can go 120,000 depending on the genetic type of the hepatitis. But assuming that it's 84,000 a pop, what are we not going to be able to do for you, your children, for public health? What are we going to take money away from in order to pay for this treatment that clears viruses from bloodstream? We don't know. This is life and death. It is not being decided in my mind in a rational way, but it's quite simply, if you were to drop the cost of that Sovaldi down to what other countries are paying, then we could have dollars available. We could say it would save lives. There's no doubt about it. And it's very frustrating. Now, this was April 7th, I believe it's in Medical Economics is where I got this from. This was about sacrifices cancer patients make to afford care. 46% of cancer patients experience anxiety associated with managing the cost of their care. And this was a cancer support community. They have a registry index report. They looked at survey data from 2,500 cancer patients who joined the registry. That means they were diagnosed with cancer between March 2013 and September 2014. They asked them some questions about what they did to be able to afford their cancer medicines. First of all, for all the people diagnosed with cancer, the 2,500 people, 48% of them had foregone vacations, celebrations, or social events. Could not afford them because they had to treat their cancer. That said, you've got cancer, but you can't take that vacation that you need to get some joy out of the life that you've got left because you can't afford it. So you say, well, vacations, that's optional. 37% cut grocery expenses.
Wow.
To pay for their cancer medicines. 36%, over one-third, depleted their savings to pay for their cancer medicines. And 24% borrowed money or used their money from their retirement plan to pay for their cancer medicines.
I believe that.
There is sadness there that when you get the diagnosis of cancer, that it depletes your retirement money. It robs your family. The cancer specialists call it financial toxicity. These drugs have financial toxicity. They ruin your quality of life, even as they may be curing or managing your cancer.
Wow.
They took a subset of those 2,500 people, the ones who had chronic myeloid leukemia, metastatic breast cancer, or multiple myeloma. These are conditions that you have to stay on the medicines a long time. If you do, you live. If you don't, you don't live. And they said, well, let's go a little bit further. What do you do? Up to 16% of them would postpone doctor's appointments because they could not afford to pay for their medical care.
Wow.
12% postpone blood tests, follow-ups. 14% postpone filling a prescription. 14% up to, depending on the diagnosis, 14% of these people would postpone filling a prescription. They could not afford to buy these cancer medicines. And then up to 10% would skip dosages of their prescribed drugs in order to save money because these medicines are
but
so
see,
expensive.
To me, that seems self-defeating because the doctors give you the prescriptions and they want to keep certain levels of that chemical in your system for a certain period of time. And so for you to basically change their prescription, you're probably not helping yourself. And wouldn't you think?
Right.
That's a dangerous one. I mean, obviously not eating's pretty dangerous too, but I'm just saying, you know, as part of your treatment, there's a certain level of dosage that your physician's kind of asking for, and boy, if you don't maintain that.
Yeah. Give you some specifics. Annual spending for the average patient with cancer is $20,000 higher in the U.S. than it is in Europe. You would save $20,000 a year on your cancer treatments average just by going to Europe. This is a type for some types of leukemia. It's a drug called Gleevec. Gleevec, a very, very potent, a very, very good, very, very effective medicine for some types of leukemia. It was introduced in 2001 at $3,400 a month. It is now $11,000 a month. In Canada, there is a generic that sells for $735 a month. U.S., $11,000. Canada, generic, $735. And unfortunately, we won't get the generic here in the U.S. until next year.
But you know, $735 is still expensive, right?
Per month, yes. Certainly you talk about $700 a month for medications, but $11,000 is just impossible. And keep in mind, if Medicare is your insurance, you're going to pay 20% of that. So 20% of the $700, 20% of the $11,000. There was a study from the American Society of Clinical Oncologists and the American Journal of Managed Care said that one in four patients would abandon their drugs if the out-of-pocket cost went over $500.
Mm.
So this tells you, I mean, I think first of all, if you have a loved one that has cancer, you've got to inquire not only about whether they're eating,
right,
whether they're seeing the doctor, but you've got to inquire about their financial health. Second, keep that in mind that these copays are going to get up in the thousands of dollars, and one in four is going to drop the medicines when it gets above 500, according to this study. So we've got some real problems. We have medicines available, yet the price of these medicines does not allow us to treat these conditions. These are in many cases, are great medicines, and if we pay for them, like Medicaid pays for them, then we wind up diverting funds that could be used to save other people's lives. It's an intolerable situation, Rick.
Yeah, boy. And just like usual, we have no answers.
No. We just...
matter of fact, we're going to leave you with a cliffhanger on this one.
Yeah.
I'd say tune in next week for the answer, but we won't have it then either.
Collectively, our name is Mud.
Right. We won't have it then either.
Yeah. Rick, let's go off the air on that depressing note.
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Spencer Johnson and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to our show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, Health Matters radio shows are indicated for the treatment of patients with gastrointestinal stromal tumors that cannot be surgically removed or have spread to other parts of the body.
Health Matters is often associated with serious fluid retention.
Boy.
It is important that patients be weighed and monitored during the show for signs of serious fluid retention or unexpected weight gain.
Now, your doctor will test your blood weekly for the first month, biweekly for the second month, and periodically thereafter. In most cases, your doctor will reduce or interrupt your Health Matters listening for low blood counts. But in rare cases, your doctor may actually discontinue the show.
If you experience severe liver problems, your doctor may stop Health Matters until the liver problem has been managed. The long-term effects of our show on growth in children are unknown. Growth retardation may be monitored in children while they listen.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for the first installment of our Ebola serial on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.